This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 17 communities in Massachusetts are now considered high risk for coronavirus infections. Six cities and towns were newly added to the list this week. We've got Worcester, Nantucket, Tingsboro, Plainville, Wrentham, and Saugus. Now, high-risk communities have more than 8 cases for every 100,000 people over a 2-week period. And so we want to start today by looking at what's happening to drive up the risk assessment in some communities around the Commonwealth. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by officials from Worcester and Saugus, but let's start with a medical perspective. Joining us now is Dr. Shira Durone. She's an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Durone.
Great to be back.
And listeners, we welcome your calls. What questions do you have about spread in your community? What do you want and need from city leadership to feel confident that the coronavirus can be contained there? Do you have information and resources that you need to keep your community safe? You can call us, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So Dr. Durone, 17 communities in Massachusetts are now designated at high risk, 6 new ones. I guess I'm wondering how worrying that is or is not. Does that worry you?
Well, it's my job to be worried. Yeah, I mean, I love to see numbers go down, not up. And, you know, we have been preparing as if there will be a second surge since really the midst of the first surge. And so we're ready for it. But, you know, of course, we've been hoping that it won't happen.
Yeah, so we have been hearing for a while about the possibility of a surge in the fall. Do you think this is the tip of that iceberg, or is it too soon to say?
You know, I was kind of expecting that with cold weather, we might see rising cases. And, you know, the weather's been a little bit colder, but, you know, this is kind of earlier than I might have thought because we have had so many nice days. You know, I thought that we've been enjoying our outdoor dining, we've been enjoying our outdoor exercise and our outdoor small gatherings, and that it would be really hard to give that up and that we might, you know, people might just bring those things indoors and that might lead to more transmission. You know, I don't know if that's happening. I feel like the weather's still been pretty good.
So what do you think might be causing it? I mean, some communities have been sustained in this high-risk zone, like Chelsea or Lawrence. Right. And then we're also hearing some reports of communities winding up with one-off reports of events that cause spikes. What do you think's going on here?
Well, when your numbers are really low, one event can really, you know, make the numbers change quite a bit, right? So, you know, we know that there is a nursing home outbreak in Wrentham. And, you know, that alone could almost be the cause of that, you know, apparent spike. You know, here in Massachusetts, we're lucky because when we talk spike, we're not talking about spikes of the size that are being seen in other states.
So the number 8 out of 100,000, so more than 8 out of 100,000 for a 2-week period, makes you a high-risk community. To the casual observer, that feels kind of random. What is the import of that number?
Well, it is to some extent random. It is to some extent an arbitrary number, and it's, you know, even those numbers are so much better than what we were seeing in March and April. But it's a trigger. It's a threshold that we need to take seriously. It's a threshold for raising, you know, sounding the alarm bells and making sure that everybody is taking note and making sure their behaviors are what they should be.
So a couple of weeks ago, there were 8 communities on the high-risk list. Now there are 17. A couple have come and gone off that list. It kind of begs the question whether we're going to play whack-a-mole as a state until there's a vaccine or major breakthrough. Are we just going to see this kind of up and down and up and down? Or is there a way to really keep a sustained suppression of high-risk?
Well, we might. We might play that whack-a-mole game that you describe, and because, you know, we are, for the most part, doing such a good job doing the things that we know work, the distancing, the masking, the hand hygiene, the surface disinfection, the staying home when sick. But we might also be getting lax, and maybe some of this will kind of whip us into shape and teach us a lesson, and, you know, maybe with a little of this, you know, fear factor, we might do better over time. It's just really hard to say.
So Dr. Durone, I know you're going to stay with us through the rest of this discussion. Thank you for that. And listeners, call in with your questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you want to know from Dr. Durone, from administrators in Worcester and Saugus about community spread, about safety measures people can take, about why we're seeing increases in changes? Again, call and we will try to answer your questions. You can be a part of this conversation. So let's add another voice here. We're going to head west to Worcester, where Dr. Michael Hirsch, the medical director of the city's Department of Public Health, joins us on the line. Welcome, Dr. Hirsch. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So Worcester has reported 6,130 total cases, with 255 of those in the last 2 weeks. And city officials report three consecutive weeks of increases in positive cases. What do you think is going on there, Dr. Hirsch?
Well, I think like your previous discussion with Dr. Durone has indicated, it's multifactorial. We are lucky in Worcester that we have 11 institutions of higher learning here, and about 9 of them have decided to come back in a physical way. 3 are still kind of all dealing with all virtual education, but that was an infusion of another 20,000 people into our previous population of about 187,000 people, and some of them came from high-risk states. Now, I think that the colleges have done a terrific job. They've coordinated with my department to kind of come up with a testing schema, and we have a reporting system, and the colleges have their own contact tracing systems that jives with ours. But at the same time, you can only do so much to patrol young people's activities after hours and on weekends, and there have been some outbreaks in several of the colleges that, are likely sources of more than just the folks that we see reporting in the colleges, because these are the young people that then go and do their shopping. They go and frequent, restaurants and bars, and that's where they can cause a spread beyond the college environment.
So, Dr. Hirsch, are you saying that you believe that the reason that Worcester is now in the high-risk zone is because of colleges that have returned students to campus?
I think it's definitely a factor because that's where we've seen some of the bigger clusters in the last 3 weeks. We also have seen clusters in families, and this would kind of go along with what Dr. Durone was talking about, that sense of laxity that I think there have been weekend and kind of summer gatherings where larger than your nuclear family have gotten together, and the spacing and the distancing and the masking and the hand washing probably wasn't as vigorous as we would have liked. And we've also seen some outbreaks in retail stores and in factory settings, where essential workers have either gotten people in their immediate area in the factory or in the big box stores sick or at least COVID positive, and then they sometimes carpool together. There's a lot of tentacles there that can spread out.
Today the city manager, Edward Augustus Jr., talked about general fatigue related to wearing masks and social distancing as a cause. Do you think that that is a piece of this picture too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a lot of fatigue, and unfortunately there's also some politicization of the wearing of a mask, and before I got on the phone with you, I was on the phone with a woman who at a local grocery store said there was a man wandering around without a mask, and several people approached him and told him to wear one, and he didn't respond very nicely. So there are some of these incidents that are going on behind the scene as well. So we're trying to drill down on this. It's not as easy as just simply the contact tracers will, get the telephone numbers of everybody that the person was in contact with and give them instructions about getting tested and this and that. But many times the people are writing down like where they live, not necessarily where they're hanging out or where they're working. So there's a lot of work that we're hoping we will get help with, that now that we're a red zone, the state is going to come in and give us some aid. And we're going to have a meeting about that tomorrow at 10 o'clock with Governor Baker's team to see how they can help us maybe knock things down back to where we were in the yellow and even for a little while in the white.
So, Dr. Hirsch, stay with us, please. I'm going to bring Saugus in a minute, but quickly, Dr. Durone, a lot of what I'm hearing from Dr. Hirsch there is people just not cooperating with the standards that we know work. What else can we do?
Well, you know, there's a movement, I guess I'll call it, of scientists that believe that low-cost, rapid at-home testing is the solution, and we can talk about that more if you like, but, you know, it's got some logistical challenges, but it's also got some promise as a potential different way to approach it.
So, listeners, what needs to happen in your community to keep your community low risk? Are your neighbors complying with mask wearing, with the appropriate social distancing? Are you worried about community spread and this kind of COVID fatigue that we're seeing that has people maybe relaxing too much or loosening their vigilance? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Shira Durone and Dr. Michael Hirsch are staying with us. I want to bring one more voice in here. We've got Scott Crabtree, town manager of Saugus. Saugus also was just added to the high-risk list for coronavirus. Welcome to Radio Boston, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Scott, what was your reaction to finding Saugus now literally in the red? 36 cases in the last 2 weeks, 690 cases total.
So I think what we're doing in Saugus is trying to focus on really more awareness and combating some of this COVID-19 fatigue, and we're using the red as helping to bring more awareness and sort of bring it back into the forefront so that people understand this is serious. We're all in desperate need of a vaccine. Or some sort of treatment for this, and until we're able to have that, we just have to follow those guidelines by the CDC and the Mass Department of Health so that we protect each other. We're all in this together, and we really have to do what we can to protect each other until that happens.
And Scott, what do you think is causing the spike in Saugus?
So I think this fluctuation, I think, every community has a unique setting. Saugus is uniquely settled with Route 1 in Saugus, which serves as a commercial base for other high-risk communities that are densely populated cities around us, such as, Revere, Malden, Lynn, Everett, Chelsea. So I think that they work here, they commute here. Saugus residents work here as well and live here. So I think that is obviously a contributor. Kids going back to college, I think it was mentioned by some of your other speakers, so that a lot of these colleges and universities are requiring testing prior to return. And I think, as everybody knows, as the science shows, that there's many people that have the virus and don't show symptoms. They're asymptomatic. So somebody gets a test and they're sort of surprised, and then it, I think, runs within that compromised house and you have other family members that test positive.
So let me ask you, Dr. Hirsch, listening to Scott here from Saugus, does that sound like a familiar set of themes? Do you feel like Worcester and Saugus are having a shared experience here, or do you feel like it's distinctive based on town or city characteristics?
I think there are some commonalities, definitely. I think the fatigue factor, like we mentioned, is probably something that everyone in the Commonwealth is experiencing, if not the nation. But I do think that we have a little different exposure rather than being exposed to some high-risk populations in the neighboring towns. Our towns are low-risk, so we have the high-risk populations kind of in our inner city, and they're comprising a lot of the essential workers. So they have been doing a wonderful job in helping keep our nursing homes going, our big box stores going, our factories going, but they don't have the right socioeconomic conditions to isolate well. They educate their kids and do daycare for their kids communally. They carpool. They do a lot of things that normally would be wonderful activities for everyone, but now in the day of COVID exposes a lot of people to exposure if somebody happens to be COVID positive. So I think these are probably shared experiences with Saugus too. I mean, like the mayor said, or the town manager said, I think we're all in this together.
Let's go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike's on the line from Beverly. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about, should I be concerned about some of the private schools that I've seen in the high-risk communities around me that are going fully open while the public school in that same district is going to be virtual?
That's a great question, Mike. Scott, are there public private schools opening in person in Saugus?
For the most part, we do have a charter that's they're fully in school. Our public schools are fully remote. They actually had a 10-day delay in starting to try to do some training with the teachers. So they started actually Wednesday, yesterday, on fully remote. And there's not a plan to go back. I think they're going to revisit it in October.
How do you feel about the fact that private schools may be in person while public schools are not doing so out of concerns for safety?
I think they have to do what they feel comfortable with the guidelines. I mean, obviously, socioeconomic factors play in there where a private school people are paying, and I think that the schools are probably got ahead of this a little bit. I think with the public schools, you're dealing with unions and negotiations on how to open and if they're safe and how, what the condition of the buildings are and their ventilation systems.
Dr. Duron, we have a Twitter question for you from at MMFarmD. It says, hi, at SI Duron. What do local schools, not colleges, use for testing? If suspected infection, are they referred to PCP? Any towns adopting their own testing a la Northeastern? PCP being, for listeners, a primary care physician. Dr. Duron.
Yeah, so great question, and hi to you. Schools, for the most part, don't have testing programs set up. It is very important that schools be thinking about how they're going to make sure that symptomatic staff and students have access to tests in an expedient manner. In other words, you need to not be waiting 7 days for an appointment and then another 7 days for results, because in that time, you might not know that that student is positive and transmission is ongoing. Contact tracing doesn't occur until the test is positive, and there may be other positive students or faculty. So it is important that every school make sure that it knows where to refer its students and faculty when they're symptomatic. That's number one most important. In terms of surveillance, asymptomatic testing of school children and teachers, there are some towns that are working on plans. There's a group of towns working together to pilot some testing, and that that can take any form. There's no right or wrong answers, but they are using the college testing plans as sort of a framework or a model. It's very expensive, and we're talking about, in some cases, public schools, so it's very logistically challenging.
I'd like to grab another call here, 800-423-8255. Beverly, you are on from Bolton. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, maybe I missed something with all this information that we've got about COVID, but are churches exempt from mask wearing? I ask because I drove past a church in West Boylston Sunday morning, and the whole congregation was outside, I mean really collectively outside gathering, and not one person had a mask on. There had to be over 100 people there. So I didn't know. I don't want to be in a communist state where you have to report people, but I certainly felt like I should have been able to tell somebody this. But honestly,
all right, well, let's talk to Dr. Michael Hirsch about that, Beverly, medical director for the city's Department of Public Health in Worcester. Dr. Hirsch.
Yeah, so there have been very strict guidelines that the governor's team from the Mass Department of Public Health has promoted about the number of people that can be in a place of worship indoors and outdoors. We had a very large mosque that was celebrating an Islamic holiday earlier in August where we had 300 people there, but they had to meet the distancing and the masking provisions in order for them to get their permit to do this. Indoors, I think the limitations had been 50 people. Now it's based on square footage, and I don't really have the formula on the top of my head, but I think that the only people that can be unmasked in the setting of a church would be a cluster of the family can sit together unmasked, but in general, the spacing has to be adequate, so at least 6 feet before another family can sit there. So I think that a citizen that is concerned like you are should definitely call their public health agent and let them know, because there are inspectors that can go and provide guidance. And if worse comes to worse, if it's a third or fourth offense, they might actually pass a citation along with a fine.
Let's turn to Scott Crabtree, town manager of Saugus, for a second. Scott, tomorrow at sundown, Rosh Hashanah begins. There will be other important holidays for various faith communities over the next several months. How are you talking to people about worshiping safely in Saugus?
So what we've done from the beginning is we have our public health director and our health department that's on an ongoing basis with communication to these different organizations, different religious organizations, as well as youth groups, and just trying to continue to educate them and to try to bring them, you know, the information they need and remind them of, you know, the guidelines and using the proper face coverings and everything else. And we haven't received many complaints in that fashion either.
Well, that's encouraging. Dr. Durone, I've got to imagine that any physician is experienced with trying to convince patients to comply with prescribed behavior, medication regimens, et cetera. So much of what we're hearing, both from Dr. Hirsch and from Scott Crabtree, really have to do with whether or not community members choose to comply. Are there public messages we could be using that we're not using effectively, or other techniques to increase people's willingness to, I mean, it's hard and it's a long slog. How do we keep everyone together on this?
It is so hard. And you know, if the message "we're in this together" doesn't work, if the message "protect each other" doesn't work, because that's really what it's about. Mask wearing, for the most part, is about making sure that you contain your germs. There's also increasing evidence that mask wearing protects you. And I think it's not a bad time to start kind of disseminating that message as well, that, you know, even if it's a cloth mask, it is protecting you from inhaling some of those viral particles as well. And so we just really need everybody to do the right thing.
Dr. Hirsch, what would your message be to the Worcester community right now?
Well, I think I was tremendously, and I continue to be tremendously proud of the way we weathered the months of the pandemic leading up to now. I think when we've been doing our pop-up testing, our positivity rate, and the stop the spread efforts of wider testing of asymptomatic people have been less than 2%. So despite the numbers that have come out that suggest that we're in the red zone, I think people, by and large, have been very, very compliant and looking out for their neighbors. I would hope that they continue with that effort because really their individual health choices affect everybody else. So we've got to pull together.
And Scott Crabtree, in our last 30 seconds or so, a message from you to your community?
I think that the community and people that visit Saugus need to really follow the guidelines and wear, you know, have social distancing, wear face coverings, and protect each other. That's the only way we're going to get through this until a vaccine is here. The fact is the virus is the same as it was 6 months ago. Nothing's changed, and we need to understand that.
And that's Scott Crabtree, town manager of Saugus. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Michael Hirsch, medical director of the city's Department of Public Health in Worcester, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And Dr. Shira Durone, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks, Dr. Durone.
Thank you.
It has been more than 6 months now since Governor Charlie Baker declared the coronavirus crisis a public health emergency here in the Commonwealth. This week, the CDC says it doesn't expect a vaccine to be widely available until late spring or summer 2021. We have been living with the virus for a good amount of time now, and we have a long way to go. So we want to bring you a new feature. We're calling it Living Through Corona, and we're going to be talking to lots of different folks from all over about their experiences during this pandemic. To start us off, we're joined by someone who quite literally lived through Corona, survived COVID. Robert Lewis Jr. is the founder and president of The Base, a nonprofit based in Roxbury that uses baseball and softball to provide academic and career resources to local student athletes. Robert, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Always great to be spending time with you. And thank you for having me on today.
Well, I'm glad to have you, Robert. You know, this feature that we're beginning, we're going to talk to a lot of folks who have had a lot of different types of experiences dealing with this pandemic. But you survived the illness. This is so real. So let me just start. How are you today? How are you now?
You know, I'm doing better, getting, you know, stronger every day, feeling better. And, you know, emotionally and mentally, I'm doing well. And, you know, it's just a blessing to be here and actually happy to be here and being able to do the work that I do.
So, Robert, if I understand it correctly, it started on your birthday. Is that right?
Yes, March 22nd.
So take us back and tell us what happened.
Yeah, March 22nd, my birthday, and, you know, just wasn't feeling all that well, shortness of breath. My wife told me that I need to probably go in, and I was like, no, I'll wait till the next day, and called the hospital and talked to one of the doctors. They said I should come right in, and I went in and thought that I was going to get a prescription and probably get sent home, and it was at that time they told me they were going – they were going to need me. I was going to need to stay and probably going to get intubated. And, you know, and that was pretty much it. And all I remember was calling my family and just telling them I was scared and I was worried. I was like petrified. Then, you know, I go upstairs and, you know, they get the IV in and running. And, you know, next thing you know, they told me they were going to sedate me. And I woke up 12 days later.
Were you in a medically induced coma, Robert? Is that what you're telling me?
Yes. And then I was on a ventilator as well, fighting for my life.
Well, I'm so sorry. I mean, that's terrifying. So you go in thinking you've got a fever and you're going to get some medicine. The next thing you know, literally the next thing you know, or don't know, you're in a medically induced coma. How is that possible that you didn't know how sick you were?
I didn't know. Like I knew I was struggling with breathing and I got that fever. But honestly, I was just thinking because, you know, I've been sick before, you know, that's a great thing. You call the hospital, you go in, they check you, they let you know what you need to do. And then you usually go back home and you rest and do everything. And I will tell you, I did not know when I woke up. My nurse was in the ICU and she put her name up on the board. And then I turned and I looked and I says, what? Because then it said April 4th. And that's when it hit me. What happened to me? What happened? And that's when I found out that I was sick. And that I was one of the survivors of being on a ventilator and making it through. But there was a long road ahead in my recovery as I was moving forward.
Were you alone in the room other than the nurse when you came to? Did you have family or friends there?
No family, no friends. I will tell you.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah, I will
tell you.
I'm
sorry, of course.
It was hard. The nurses and the doctors would come in usually in the morning for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, check my vitals. The doctor would come in. And remember, I went in on March 22nd when I went to the hospital. I'm talking to a doctor. Yes, and, they had a face mask on. But then I wake up 12 days later, they're walking in, and they have all the PPE stuff on in the whole nine yards. And that was just another culture shock, is that the protective gear that people had to wear and the conversation and all of this. And, you know, that's when I, like, realized, oh, my goodness, something is going on. And that's when I also realized how weak I was. And I knew at that point, I'm going to have a fight, not just to survive, just I'm going to have a fight to recover. And that was where the next 13 days was being in the hospital, recovering, and then at BMC, and then spending the last 7 days at Spalding rehab, and Spalding actually getting me back where I can walk and get off an oxygen mask, being able to touch my nose and being able to tie my sneakers again.
You couldn't touch your nose or tie your sneakers when
they
you
asked me to touch my nose, and I was touching my cheek and my forehead, and I could not bend over to tie my sneakers because I didn't have breath, you know. And when I got up in Spalding and walked 2 to 3 steps, I had to go back and sit in my chair, and I needed oxygen. And this was, you know, again, this was going to be a tough recovery. And it was, on one end, I was happy to be alive. But then it was like, oh, my goodness, what's it going to take for me to go home? I wanted to go home. At that time, I didn't see my family. I talked to them on the phone. And I'm not going to lie to you, your mind and your head, you're just going through crazy thinking. And because you're totally isolated and by yourself, except for the extraordinary nurses and doctors that were there to look out for you.
Robert, it sounds like an odyssey. It literally sounds like you accidentally got in a time machine. You came out the other side, and now you're in this survival odyssey. What was it like to go home? You wanted to get home. 13 days later, you go home. What was that like?
Wow. It was amazing when my daughter picked me up at Spalding and to see her. And then to pull up at my house and my son, you know, and, you know, his partner, you know, their daughter, you know, standing out front of my house with a sign and like, we love you, Dad, we love you. And, you know, your wife, because my kids couldn't go inside, right? And they were all in masks. And again, that was so surreal. And even the ride home, because nobody was out on the street. And then you get home and, you know, again, you see your family, and that was very emotional. And for 7 days, you know, we were home and I had to wear a mask at home with my wife, and we weren't able to let my kids or family in for 7 days, right? So it was like even quarantining even more. And then it was on the 8th day when my daughter and my son were able to come in and see me, and to be there with my family meant the world to me. But I also knew at that time I was just going to go through a pace of recovering, knowing I was going to have a visiting nurse and a physical therapist checking in with me. And then it was 4 days after I got home is when I found out that one of my dear friends died from COVID. And, you know, other information, I had one of my last surviving aunts ended up dying of cancer. And you just realize, like, during those 25 days that I was in, things were happening, like losing a dear friend and your aunt and just other things. Because while I was in the hospital, I would not watch the news. I just refused to watch the news because it just wasn't anything good. And it was just getting home and seeing your family and being able, honestly, to hug them and tell them you love them just meant the world to me.
Robert, I'm so sorry that you lost people close to you. And I know it was a time when you couldn't grieve them the way that you would want to either. It's so clear that your family is such a source of love and strength for you. Where else have you drawn strength from during this process of recovery? Where else did you get your strength?
Tiziana, you know, it's been interesting. One is, I didn't pick up my cell phone for 12 days once I got home. And I picked up the cell phone and then the text messages and the voice messages from your dear friends. I found out that my daughter and a group of friends did a Zoom prayer for me, and over 150 people were on that. And I got my strength from, you know, your friends and other family members. It took me a while. Then I came back, probably about 60 days later. I popped in the office and seen some of my colleagues for like the first time and talked to some of my board members at the base for the first time. And every one of them were very, very emotional, every one of them. And the strength that I continue to get is, you know, we follow the governor's phases and precautions, and we open up a little bit for our young folks. But the real strength came from, you know, the inequities. We needed to make sure that the young folks at the base were not just getting food bags, but we were going to feed them. We needed to make sure that we were checking in on how they were doing. And they were struggling, and both mentally, emotionally, and sports, which they love. But the mentorship that we provided wasn't, you know, they were missing that because we were closed for three plus months. So my strength every day is not just my family, my friends, but it's looking at the faces of our young folks from Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, and beyond, and our young Black and brown young men and women, and knowing that I'm here because I have another opportunity to make an impact in their lives. And I'm going to use my bully pulpit. I'm going to use the strength and the power that I have to ensure that they're going to be able to get the resources, the love, and the support that they need, because they wholeheartedly deserve this. This is taking an impact on our communities and our lives, on top of what's happening around the issues of, you know, the racial injustices and inequities that are also happening both locally, regionally, and nationally.
I have wondered, Robert, how going through this affected your understanding of the work you do at the base. I don't wonder about your level of commitment, because I knew how high it was before. I can't imagine it could have gotten any higher. But we are in a time of incredible upheaval that is so hard on our young people. What is changing for you in how you think about your work?
You know, I think a few things. One is, I think one of the first things that really, you know, that I look back and appreciate it is the incredible staff and board and folks, honestly, that we have, and incredible supporters and funders and donors. And I say that real, because at the base, we say 1, 2, 3, base, 4, 5, 6, family. Our board, our staff and folks have stepped up like as family members. Our biggest thing was to really check in with our folks to see how they were doing, and the power of social media, the power of the telephone and cell phones has been critical. I think our biggest thing that we have made a commitment to is, how are we going to access and use our space in a way, because we can't serve everybody? And how are we going to do that? How are we going to ensure that our young folks that were transitioning to college, that we could check in with them? And also our young folks that are worrying about their high school years or middle school years of what we're looking to do. We're looking to partner with EBA, Latinos for Education, the Y, on creating our own learning pods here at the base. But it's really forcing me, our team, and others to really act differently. And this is such an unknown, right? So the thing that I'm just reminding our folks is, we got to wear a mask, got to wash your hands, and you got to social distance as best you can. And we all collectively have to take on this fight, because I'd say with the pandemic and what's happened around racial inequalities, the stake of our young folks for generations to come, that's at stake right now. And despite what's happening, we still are morally obligated. And let me repeat that. We're morally obligated to ensure that our young folks get the love, support, and the resources that they need each and every single day just for their survival, while continuing to be there to support them and their families however we can.
That is Robert Lewis Jr., founder and president of The Base, a nonprofit based in Roxbury that uses baseball and softball to provide academic and career resources to local student athletes. Robert, I just want to thank you so much for being with us today and being so generous to share your story.
Tiziana, thank you. And thank you for what you do in bringing these stories to light. I love and appreciate you.
Thank you, Robert. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Finally today, let's go to another of Boston's hidden sacred spaces. These are the sounds of the Cable Synagogue, a light open chamber built into the Hebrew Senior Life Rehabilitation Center in Roslindale. The synagogue now sits silent, shuttered by the coronavirus pandemic that has ravaged senior homes in Massachusetts and across the country. And Hebrew Senior Life did not escape the pandemic. The home reports 53 people succumbed to COVID-19 at the beginning of the outbreak. But before the pandemic, residents, staff, and family members used to gather at the Cable Synagogue for a very different kind of music service. Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman brings us back there.
So Edith, are you ready?
Edith is 89-year-old Edith Klein-Drieser. She's sitting in the front row of the synagogue, getting ready for her solo.
Right now, I have cough drops in my mouth.
It's okay.
I'm going to sing.
Yeah. Klein-Drieser bears a striking resemblance to her idol, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Upstairs in my room, on the door, I have the picture of the Ginsburg lady.
The musicians are warming up near the front of the room. Once they're ready to go, it's time for Edith's big moment.
Ready, Edith? Don't worry.
Don't worry.
I really wanted to sing that song, and it's repetitive, and to me, it says what Shabbat is about, which is everything's going to be all right.
That's Hallie D.H. Adue, the creator of the sing-along and Hebrew Senior Life's chaplain. D.H. Adue used to only hold a Kabbalat Shabbat on Friday afternoons, the traditional Jewish evening service. But they say they wanted to create a musical service beforehand that could appeal to residents of different faiths. Bob Marley was their inspiration.
You've got this moment in time, everything is going to be all right. And so I changed some of the words, and then I started saying it was the anniversary of Bob Marley's bar mitzvah. And, you know, the people with dementia were like, oh, all right.
And it works for Mary Robichaud. She's a Catholic who lives at the senior center and has been coming to the singing services for the past year.
My son calls from France and they say, where's Mary? She's in the synagogue. He said, oh, Mother of God, help us. She's in the synagogue praying.
Dozens of staff from the senior center accompany the residents, many of whom cannot walk down to the synagogue themselves.
Music is very important. It's very important to me, especially gospel music.
Activities coordinator Philippa Robitaux says she grew up in Belize listening to gospel music. And those songs now help her unwind at the end of her shifts. Her favorite, Since I Laid My Burden Down. She told D.H. Adue about it. Now, it's part of the Friday service.
Life is sweeter since I laid my burden down.
Music is very, very important in the patient life, because some patient may not respond to nothing, and the minute they hear music, their eyes could be closed, but you can see their hands or their feet moving.
Many of the patients at Hebrew Senior Life have dementia, but staff seem to agree that music helps them connect to feelings and memories when language can't.
Seeing them go and really soak it in is amazing because of their disease, you know, as opposed to someone who really knows that I'm going to the synagogue. But music is universal. Yeah, it is universal.
That's Susan Kalinda, one of the nurse managers on a dementia floor.
Yeah, we're doing something good for them, for them going out there and seeing who knows what they're feeling when they are in that presence of the synagogue. Mm-hmm. It's definitely different from this routine. So it does good for them.
Susan says she and her team are always looking for ways to connect with their patients. She says about half her floor grew up speaking Russian, so she and her staff are learning Russian.
Yes, dobro otra, dobro day, that's good morning or good afternoon.
Jati bele blue, I love you. That's my number one that I always learn, jati bele blue. I love that set of phrase.
That's Kalinda, who grew up in Uganda, and Yvette Robinson from Panama. In many ways, Hebrew Senior Life reflects the larger demographics of elder care in America. Immigrants from places like Haiti, Panama, Uganda, and Samoa fill a disproportionate role in caring for an aging, mostly white population. It's hard work, physically and emotionally. Hali Diachidue says they keep this in mind as they try to be a chaplain for both the residents and the staff in a place where death is a constant part of life and dealing with it is part of the job.
We sustain over 150 deaths a year. So people are they're opening their hearts and loving these people and then getting their hearts broken almost every day. So they're coming to me with that. They're coming to me with, how do I love the next person who moves into that bed? Because we are a spiritual organization, but we're also a business. So that bed is going to be filled the next day.
Nurse Yvette Robinson says that's the hardest part.
You feel a part of you is gone. And that's a hard thing that we have, you know, we wish everybody could be alive, but it ain't like that. And we wish the disease wasn't like this, but it ain't like that. This is part of life, so we have to learn how to deal with it. And it's not a beautiful process, but we're there. At least we know that we did our part to at least bring a little joy in life.
One of those joys, every Friday, people like Yvette and Susan wheel patients down to the synagogue to sing. In this space, this odd family from all corners of the world comes together to connect with something universal.
That story from Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman. It was recorded back in November, before senior homes were shut off from the public. To hear the first two pieces in our series on Boston's hidden sacred spaces, visit our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.